everyone, and welcome back to the Gods of Thrones podcast by Bald Move, or the officially unofficial podcast for all things HBO's Game of Thrones. I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Anthony.
And we are back for the second week promoing Gods of Thrones, getting everyone excited for Game of Thrones. We're going to be discussing a few topics from our new book, our volume two of Gods of Thrones. There's already volume one we did last year. We're gearing up for the release of volume two. Topics include the curious fact that all of Rickard Stark's grandchildren seem capable of warging. The fabulous and mysterious mythology and legend of Bran the Blessed, an old British myth, and how it might relate to our favorite Bran. And finally, Jack and Hagar, is he a genie?
And does he look like Will Smith? Actually,
and if so, could Will Smith play him in the reboot 20 years from now?
Is he the love child of Will Smith and a Smurf?
Yes, yes, yes. It's a serious topic. It's actually a surprisingly interesting topic, and we'll give it the seriousness it deserves. And as always, if you like any of our discussions here on about this Gods of Thrones, just be aware there's two volumes worth of material that Anthony and I have written in the off season. We had so much time off since the last season of Game of Thrones in season 7. We decided, what the hell, we'll write two books.
Why not two? Why not?
Yeah.
What is better than one, Aaron? Two.
Two. Unless the thing is a bad thing, and neither of these books are bad things. So
I actually think book two might be better than book one. What do you think?
I think it's like arguing over who your children are best. So do you prefer your daughter's company or your son's? I'm putting you on the record.
My children know I have preferences.
Fine. Oh, okay. Well, I dodged that question by just having the one.
Okay.
So he can always be my favorite. He's also the worst. Okay. Oh, one other exciting thing is one of the really, really stupendously good parts of this project is we were gracious enough to be able to, or not gracious enough, I don't know. I don't know the right word. We were lucky enough to land the talents of Chase Stone, who's a noted fantasy illustrator. A lot of the illustrations from the official World of Ice and Fire are his artwork, and it turns out he listens to our podcast, and he was kind of interested in helping us out on the project. And we've done six just amazing original pieces of artwork inspired by Game of Thrones, and you can click on, if you click on the show notes, it'll take you to the project page for Volume 2, where you can see one of them on the cover, and you can navigate to Volume 1 and ooh and ah over that. And now you can get some merch. If you want t-shirts, if you want posters, if you want other products that have this fantastic art that would look good on any cubicle, in any office wall, in any den of geekery, regardless of whether you like Gods of Thrones or not, the artwork is legit and it's amazing. It's cool. Check out godsofthrones.com to be taken to our merch store. You can also get links to buy the books there too. So it's kind of your one-stop shop, godsofthrones.com. And now without further ado, we're going to get into the meaty meat of this year podcast.
All right.
Hey, everybody. I'm doing a ad hoc update to the podcast here because there's been some screwy stuff going on with our Amazon pre-order for Gods of Thrones Volume 2. Now, longtime fans of Bald Move will know that this isn't our first dust-up with Amazon. So if you're familiar with that history, you can chalk this up to the latest round of Bezos Revenge. We had to actually pull it out of pre-order. Everyone that did pre-order should have gotten their money refunded, at least according to Amazon. And I'm working to get that resolved. I'm still pretty certain. I was going to be 100% certain we'd meet the release date until this happened. But I'm still feeling very hopeful by hitting the release date of April 9th, which is next week this time. But we did have a little snafu and I had to pull that. Sorry if you were one of the people that did support us and purchased a book on Amazon. We should get this stuff resolved real quick. If you go to godsofthrones.com, as soon as it's released, it will be up there, or as soon as it's back into pre-order. And also, I'll try to keep people updated on Twitter, Facebook, and the usual channels. All right, without further ado, back to the podcast. All right, Anthony, like last week, I thought we could just bring a kind of a potpourri sort of fun topic selection from our new Volume 2 of Gods of Thrones. I have a couple of topics here. I thought maybe one we could start with the discussion. This is something that might be new information or a new thought to show watchers only, but it's been something that's been discussed a lot amongst book readers for some time, and that's the fact, the curious fact, that all of Rickard Stark's grandchildren seem capable of warging.
Right. So now, the show seems to not just remove direwolves willy-nilly without explanation.
Yeah. Budget cuts.
Yeah, right. Budget cuts. But they've also removed some really interesting character features.
Yeah, and we say, you know, it's not commonly heard to refer to the Stark children as Rickard Stark's grandchildren, but in an effort to be precise, that's what I use, because as we found out last season, and we've long suspected from reading the books, that Jon Snow is not actually Ned Stark's son. He is Ned Stark's nephew.
That's Wait,
right.
What?
That's right. He's not even... Apparently, his name's Aegon, too, if you really want to get
Aaron, it. Aaron, you've ruined this for me.
A mind blower. But so we said Rickard Stark's grandchildren just to, as an effort to be precise and not to have anybody, John's actually not, he's still a Stark. He's also a Targaryen, but he's not Ned Stark's son. He's Rickard Stark's grandchildren. They all got direwolves, and they all seem capable of some ability to do warging or even greenseeing. So let's talk about these guys from, like, most significant evidence for warging to least significant.
So Bran would be the most significant. I mean, he's the most talented greenseer. He wargs in and out of creatures most often, right?
Is green scenester, is that like the hip? Is that the hipster goth version of a scenester in well, they wear all black.
We're talking about lots of green. The Green New Deal.
Lots of vines. Lots of still dark eyeshadow, right, and, you know, pallid complexions. But yeah, I mean, he's we don't need to argue about him being a warg. I think second in evidence is Jon Snow. There's a lot of evidence in the books, especially, that show that Jon has a connection with Ghost that's very close to, you know, to like Bran levels of warging. There's a when he's off with Corrin Halfhand in the Frostfangs, he gets a dream where it's pretty obvious that he's actually seeing events through Ghost as he's hunting, and Ghost is up in this mountain pass and he sees this huge wildling army amassed. And when Jon wakes up, he kind of sheepishly tells his fellow black brothers, "Hey, I had this weird dream." And these experienced rangers immediately understand that he's just had some kind of wolf dream, and he's been able to get valuable intelligence through the eyes of his wolf.
Yeah.
And
the idea here is that beyond the wall, to be a skin changer is recognizable. This is something that people would know. This is a category people are not, they don't just assign to legend.
Right.
So they are able to recognize Jon for what he is, but he's, you know, having grown up in Winterfell, he just doesn't have that category to work with.
Right. He doesn't know that that's a thing, but the Rangers do. And significantly later in the series, he encounters a unquestionable skin changer. Guy's name's like Varamyr. Is it Varamyr?
Varamyr Sixskins.
Sixskins, because he's changed into six different skins, and he immediately recognizes. He first asserts that a skin changer can recognize another one kind of on site, like a Highlander kind of. Like there's a Highlander buzz about them. And he clocks Jon Snow as a warg. And you know, it's funny because there's a lot of people that thought, because in the book series especially, they definitely talk about this in the show too, when someone gets resurrected, there's always a piece of their soul or something that makes them distinct and special that's left behind. And the more they get resurrected, like extreme examples, the Lightning Lord, Beric Dondarrion, he talks about himself as being kind of like a thin shadow of what he used to be.
Right.
And it's like, well, that's no good for our main protagonist. We don't want a protagonist that's like a half man. And a lot of people suspected that Jon was going to emergency warg his consciousness into Ghost while he was dead. His body would be resurrected through some kind of zombie Lord of Light machinations, and then his soul would be returned intact to him when he re-emerges from ghost consciousness. That's kind of like, that theory has been referred to as the ghost as refrigerator hypothesis.
Right, yeah.
Because it puts Jon Snow in cold storage and keeps him fresh and non-freezer burned. So so Jon's most likely a warg, certainly in the books. Let's talk about
Arya.
Arya. Okay, let's go with Arya. What's the canonical Arya evidence for
warging? So Arya also has wolf dreams, and she even continues to have her link with Nymeria while she's in Essos. She's in Braavos, and so in other words, the connection, the astral projection, the spiritual projection, whatever you want to say, she can enter Nymeria, even across the sea, and she's able to see through Nymeria's eyes. And, of course, this is the famous origin of Lady Stoneheart, which, of course, is also not in the show. In addition to that...
elaborate, Nymeria actually comes across the corpse of Catelyn Stark, because this is pretty metal,
right.
and grabs her skull in its jaws and drags it out of the Trident River, where it's promptly discovered by the Brotherhood Without Banners, and the rest is history.
Yeah, yeah, and so there's. I mean, it's pretty clear that Arya is able to project into Nymeria, but in addition to that, when she is she's blind in the House of Black and White, she's blinded basically, and she's able to see through a cat, the eyes of a cat who's in the courtyard. So she's not just able to see through the eyes of her wolf, but she's able to see through other animals. Although, you don't get the sense that she can't. She has this talent developed to any great ability, you know, any great extent.
Right. Now, the really interesting thing is this is one of the kind of war connections that's at least a little bit hinted, kind of sort of, by the show, because most people thought that we'd never hear from Nymeria again. Like, once the Lady Stoneheart connection wasn't made, it's like, when would she show up? But she did show up last season as a character kind of grace moment to show that how much Arya has changed. And reflecting Nymeria's change. Like, Nymeria no more wants to go back to be Arya's pet in Winterfell than Arya would want to go back to be, you know, Ned's little girl doing needlepoint. She's untamed and fierce and wild, just like Arya is. But, you know, if you look at the trailer, there's a lot of it looks like there's evidence of big wolves running around some of these battlefields. Is it possible that Nymeria will, if not be Arya's pet, be an ally in some of these battles?
Well, I still go back to this idea that I think that the Double Ds are very aware that the fans want more direwolves.
Yes.
And I think maybe the budget, the CGI budget, is kind of a smokescreen. I think that if you can kind of... if you can push the direwolves out of the screen for a couple seasons, for the most part, then they can show up as these hulking creatures as big as a horse in this final go-around. And it's sort of like this thrill for the viewer. Haven't seen these wolves for a while, and look how much they've grown. I think that could be something of a reveal.
Yeah, definitely. Pumps up interest. You get people desperate for dire wolves, and then, you know, it's so much the sweeter when you finally get them and they're a pivotal part. So we'll see. Let's talk about Rob. So Rob in the books is interesting because he's this very young green military commander and fighter. He's a very young boy, but he's able to out fox and out wily, the very wily and foxy, to be honest, Tywin Lannister,
right?
And not just once, but several times. And one of his key accomplishments is getting Tywin to be unaware that the bulk of his forces has crossed over into the Westerlands, until it's too late, because Tywin has this very impressive military fortification called the Golden Tooth.
Mm-hmm.
That's this little watchtower that oversees all the approaches that a large army could take.
Right. But he thinks that there's no way Rob is going to bring his army over without us being able to see it happen.
Exactly, which will, you know, that leaves out the element of surprise. Rob is able to discover this goat path that's just wide enough for a man on horse to traverse this pass and bypass the Gold Tooth. And there's POV points in the books where they ascribe, it says that the Grey Wind showed Rob this path. Mm-hmm. Now, there's two ways this could go down. It could go this elaborate Lassie-style pantomime where, you know, Grey Wind comes up to Rob, starts barking. What is it, boy? What is it? There's a goat's path in the Westerland Mountains. Or he could just be unconsciously warging and seeing it, and maybe sees it as a dream. Maybe he sees it as a hunch. Maybe he sees it as a suspicion. But that Grey Wind is his like ace in the hole, his military intelligence that no one else has.
Yeah, and with Rob, you kind of have a sense that even he's not fully asleep, but he may be just like in a trance, sort of half awake, studying the all of the battle pieces.
Yeah,
and it could be that he is able to sort of use Grey Wind as intel, even if he's not dreaming.
Yeah, his wife in the book says that she's worried about him because he spends nights just staring catatonically over his battle maps. And we know that when Bran is warging in summer, that he kind of looks like he's catatonic or he's unresponsive. He can't be roused from the sleep. So there's another little evidence that Jon's doing some warging, some green seeing, which brings us to Rickon. Rickon has got the ricketiest evidence of warging in the books. Essentially, he's kind of warging by proxy, because when Bran is stuck in Winterfell after he's been paralyzed and he's with Master Luwin, he gets this very disturbing dream about his father returning to the crypts of Winterfell, which is his first clue that his father's dead. Rickon gets that same dream, and in fact, we find that he is exploring the catacombs of Winterfell with his dog, Shaggy Dog.
Yeah.
So there's this hint that like he has getting some of the same prophetic dreams that his brother gets. Shaggy Dog shows a lot of agitation when Rickon's agitated, that there is this kind of, and you got to keep in mind that Rickon's very small in the books.
Yeah. The other thing with Rickon is that there's this repeated observation in the books that he's almost like a feral child.
He's wild.
He's as wild as Shaggy Dog. We hear that over and over and over.
Yeah.
And what ends up happening is Rickon, really, you can't trust Shaggy Dog. I mean, Shaggy Dog could just maul you at any moment.
Yeah.
And it's almost as if instead of Rickon learning to control Shaggy Dog, that Shaggy Dog has really influenced Rickon's, I don't know, civility.
Right. And that makes sense. If you had, like, imagine you had a 3-year-old child and they had the magical ability to project their mind into a wolf and vice versa. Talk about the terrible twos. You'd have the wolfsome threes and it would be no good. It'd be no good at all. it's weak. And in the show, the only character development Rickon makes past, you know, getting kidnapped by Theon is his inability to run zigzag, leading to his untimely death. So this is not a thing in the show, but it's definitely a thing in the books. And that leads us to the weakest warg in the Stark family, Sansa Stark.
Well, yeah, with Sansa, it's interesting to me because we're given all of these hints about the Stark children.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the sense that, you know, in book one, at least, all of Ned Stark's children, on the surface of it, look like they have some kind of spiritual connection with these wolves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's over and over repeated. And so you get the sense that Sansa probably also has a connection. But of course, we know that Lady is slaughtered by Ned.
Right.
And you know, in the show, it's sort of like Sansa's just kind of weeping because her pet died. Uh-huh. But I think in reading the books, you do get this sense that this is actually quite a loss for Sansa.
Yeah.
It's not just like, you know, poor girl with her pet's dead. There's like a part of her that dies with the wolf if you've already bought in on the other Stark children, right?
Right.
And made the assumption that Sansa, if she could develop this, would have the same kind of projection that the other kids have had. Of course, the wolf dies, and so we never get to see Sansa develop. Yeah, I know it's Sansa. So we never get to see Sansa develop the her warging abilities.
And it's the wolf doesn't just die, not to slaughter by Ned's hand, but really the reason Lady dies is because Sansa betrays her own pack. So it's kind of like that thematic like betrayal that might also like she betrayed her inner Starkness and the sigil of the family, and that's what led to her connection being cut off. But there's been some enterprising theorieteers that have said that Sansa does have mastery of wolves and dogs, and it's in the form of her beguiling and bewitching Sandor.
Oh, the hound.
He kind of is her sword and shield for a lot of part of her being vulnerable in King's Landing. And, you know, she's got this way of singing that kind of makes him feel at peace or gives him some kind of a good emotional feelings from his fellow humans. I don't know if that's something that George is trying to hint at thematically or it's actually intended to show her being... Like maybe that her unconscious warging ability or undeveloped, untrained warging ability allows her to get insights into the minds of men and women, which allows her to get the better of Littlefinger in the end. I don't know, but it also makes sense if she can't warg at all. It's because she lost her training, her warg training dummy at a very young age and as a result of her own shitty actions.
That's right. That's right. I mean, I don't know. I don't really buy that theory as well, simply because I think that there is some sort of zoomorphic literary agency happening here. And it's the fact that the hound is Jeffrey's dog, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Joffrey's dog. And Sansa is... She's like a little caged bird. That's what the hound keeps saying. He calls her little bird or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so you've got these, I guess you've got these archetypal ideas of what those things will look like. And then of course, Martin loves to subvert these. He likes to subvert the archetypes. So I don't know if Sandor ever becomes Sansa's dog. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's really. I think he's finding his humanity, and part of finding his humanity is liberating the Stark girls.
So let's take a step back and say, what could all this mean? I mean, on one level, it's just Martin giving these brothers and sisters like the Umbrella Academy level of like abilities, and they're kind of coming together in a Fantastic Four kind of way, and maybe they'll each have their little time to shine in the wars to come, or it could just be like a literary like device that's kind of bringing all these brothers and sisters together, even though they're separated by vast distances. And
that the books do that the show doesn't is that in the books, Maester Luwin is actually half chimpanzee.
Right. As a result of some of Ned's less savory experimentation. Sure.
Right.
Or maybe it's Kat. She's into blood magic and fucking with genetics. Who knows? The Southern ladies, you can't trust them.
Yeah. No, I think that there's a sense here that the Starks have the blood of the First Men running in their veins.
Mm-hmm.
And Martin is really playing with this idea of supernatural heritage. Like you've inherited something in your blood that's going to if you're able to develop the talent, then it's going to allow you to ride a dragon or warg into a tree or, you know. And but you get the sense that after centuries of the maesters schooling people in sort of a proto-modernity, that a lot of this has been lost in Westeros. A lot of right. this idea, these ideas that that you can use magic as a weapon, these are all fairy tales.
So kind of a connection, since we're on the Starks here, there's another theory we discussed, because a lot of these, a lot of this stuff is from a chapter where we're talking about, you know, Weirwood type stuff, Bran being weird and wizards and some of this other kind of a, like northern cleanup religion and culture tasks that we've left ourselves from volume one. And you talk about Bran's potential connection with this mythological figure from British lore, Bran the Blessed.
Now, this is something I found. I totally had no idea about this before we started writing. But I remember finding this and texting you and saying, did you know that Bran means crow in Welsh?
And I said, no, I did not.
I had no idea either. So, I mean, it makes sense. In the show, he becomes a three-eyed raven, but in the books, it's Brendan Rivers is the three-eyed crow, which means that he's sort of the master puppeteer in the north, right? He's the master green seer. So it could be that Martin is getting this connection between Bran and crows from this famous mythology in British and Welsh lore. And this goes back to a myth called Bran the Blessed. And I'll give you the 30-second version of the story. So there's this Bran, and he's a giant, and he's the king of the Englands. The Ings.
the Englands, yes.
So he's the king of England, and he's a giant, and he sees a boat coming from far away because he can see very, very far. And it's the king of Ireland who's coming to treat with the Ings. And so anyway, they're hanging out, they're having a great time, and Bran says, "Here, I'll let you marry my sister Branwen, and we'll make this a family affair, and we'll have this great strong treaty." And so they're having this thing in an outdoor tent because no building can contain Bran the Blessed. And then Evnissen comes by, and Evnissen is like a trickster character, but he's really deranged. And he's the brother of Bran and Branwen, and he realizes that no one's consulted him on this treaty. And moreover, no one's consulted him on the giving of his sister in marriage. And so what he decides to do is he decides to mutilate the horses of the Irish. And the original text is really disgusting. It talks about the horses being cut to the bone and their ears and eyelids are taken off and just really gross stuff.
PETA would not approve.
PETA would definitely not approve. And the Irish get all ticked off and they're going to leave. And then...
You fucked our horses, mate.
Yeah, that's
right. You fucked up the horses.
That's right. They're really been out of shape about this. And so Bran says, don't leave. I'll give you my resurrection cauldron. And it's the first time we find out that he's got a resurrection cauldron.
He has one of these. Okay.
So the basic idea is a big pot, and if you throw a dead body in it, then the next day the person will be alive again. So I'm gonna kind of cut to the end here. Basically, the English and the Irish go to war, and unfortunately, Bran is killed in the war. He's not actually killed. He's crippled. All right. So wink and a nod. We got Bran in Game of Thrones. Who's crippled? He gets shot with a poison arrow in his ankle. And Bran's idea is, look, you got to get me back to the Tower of London, which hasn't been built yet. And you've got to get me back there. So just cut off my head and carry my head back. So the rest of his body's dead, but he's this basically this talking head that they bring back. And the legend has it is that Bran's head is buried beneath the Tower of London, facing toward France.
And so you can keep an eye on him.
Yeah, warding off sort of French invaders. And could be that there's some connection between this mythology and the ravens that are kept in the Tower of London.
Because there's an unrelated or possibly distantly related mythology that there's these crows that live in the Tower of London, and if they ever leave the tower, then England will fall.
Right. So yeah, the Raven Master is supposed to keep them, and if you ever visit, that you can see these ravens. They all have names, and there's like I don't know 6 or 7 of them. But the idea here is that there's a superstition that if ever these ravens were to leave the tower, then England would just crumble to the ground.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like there's also some other kind of motifs there, like that's very similar to like a Stark must always be in Winterfell.
Right.
I mean, well, what if there's not? You know, the idea that this guy's got far-reaching vision and he can kind of like, which is the same as being able to see into the future. If you can see further than anyone else around you, then you can see things coming towards you. It's essentially like predicting the future. And I'm intrigued by this resurrection cauldron. Is like, because that's the one, because so far this stuff is just basically descriptive theories, like, oh, these match up, but like,
yeah,
is it possible that Bran is going to use some kind of freaky deaky tree magic to reverse some sort of mortal outcome in the wars to come?
Right. Well, we know that Martin likes to merge these mythologies and like hint toward them without necessarily following them like a script.
Mm-hmm.
But notice a few connections here. So Bran is, his body doesn't function in the way that he wants it to function, you know, like a knight's body would function. So he's basically this mind. He's this super duper genius, weirwood connected mind, and he's underground.
Mm-hmm.
So in the same way that Bran the Blessed is just this basic head protecting England beneath the ground, maybe Bran is functioning in that way. But in addition to that, Bran sometimes wargs himself into a giant, which is Hodor, right?
Oh, right.
And if you want a third, because of course we always do these things in threes, right?
Rules of three, yeah.
Bran, we have the sense that talented green seers can get themselves a second life when they die.
Mm.
So Martin is playing with resurrection in this case because once Bran dies, he can kind of resurrect himself by projecting his life force into an eternal weirwood tree.
Because that's a point that I don't think is made in the shows, but it's made in the books, is that weirwoods are they are immortal creatures.
Yeah, like, if they are not cut down or burned, they will live forever.
They're like vampire immortal. In absence of someone cutting their heads off or whatever, that they're going to live forever. Their wood is impervious to rot, etc. So, like, I think that's interesting that I could see an end game where Bran merges with the Heart Tree in Winterfell, the Godswood in Winterfell. Because the one that, like, it seems like where the three-eyed raven was, that's the kind of canonical resting place for all these old green singers.
Yeah.
And Brandon is, like, Rivers is in the process of the books of merging with those trees, like a decomposed corpse with roots growing out of his eye sockets and all kinds of freaky shit. But I could see Bran kind of doing the same thing with the Heart Tree of Winterfell, which would, you know, be not too far removed from being buried under a tower where you could be eternally vigilant.
In addition to that, I think you could make a case, and people probably have made this case before, that the old gods are simply ancient green seers
that have
taken for themselves a second life in the Weirwood network.
Right.
So that's where these things come from. Instead of projecting yourself into a bird like Varamyr Sixskins, a bird's just going to live for another couple years.
Yeah.
If you are talented enough to project yourself into the Weirwood network, you essentially become one of the old gods.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, because I also wonder sometimes if there's a Stark must always be in Winterfell is a corruption of the original phrase, which is Stark is always in Winterfell, because there's some ancient Stark that happens to embody that particular winter Weirwood, or into a sense that there's been green seers that are Starks in the past, which we pretty much are certain of, that they would be able to kind of go throughout the Weirwood network like any other green seer that's died would. So I think there's some interesting, perhaps, things that George could play with in the books. Clearly, that we're not going to get any of this. It's if or if it is, it's going to be a very stripped down version in the show. But it's another interesting thing where George has taken local mythology and religion and switched around the details and used it to inspire him.
That's right. That's right.
Finally, I really was taken with one of your theories in the second book when we talk about the religion of the faceless men, which, you know, obviously is something we wanted to get to. You made a pretty compelling point that Jack and Hagar is a literary allusion to a genie or a djinn.
Oh, yeah, this is one of my favorites. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, let's talk about that.
Okay, so this, you deserve all credit for this because I did not know about Search for Ice and Fire before we started this project.
Oh yeah.
So Search for Ice and Fire is a great website that basically you can do a search for any word in any of Martin's Ice and Fire canon, right?
Yeah, if you go to searchoficeandfire.com, it takes you there, and it's just as Anthony says, it's got full text of all of the books and the Hedge Knight series and short stories and all that stuff, and you can just search a phrase or a word, and you can see how many times it appears and in context where it appears in the series.
Right, so this has been really invaluable for us when we were writing these two volumes, because if ever you wonder, like, I wonder if this ever pops up, this word ever pops up somewhere else. So I'm reading through this chapter on Arya's encounter with, help me on the guy's name again, Jack and Hagar. Jack and Hagar. And I'm thinking, I wonder if she, because he gives her three names to offer to the Red God. So that's all that kind of piqued my interest.
She gets wishes three,
and I think, oh man, this is. I wonder if this is a literary allusion. Uh-huh. So I did a search on a search for Ice and Fire for polishing, because I thought, what would be the key element for if you wanted to hat tip to the Aladdin story?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, how does the genie pop out?
Yeah, Aladdin's rubbing the lamp.
And has to polish the lamp, right? So, just before this happens, Martin uses this word to polish, and he doesn't use it very often. Mm-hmm. So basically, what happens is Arya is thinking about the people she wants to kill, and she's coming up with her kill list, and she's reciting it like a prayer. Each night. Mm-hmm. And Martin says she polished her hates just like Gendry polished his armor, something like that. Mm-hmm. Well, in the very next chapter, what happens? After she's been polishing her hates, this guy pops up, Jack and Hagar, and he basically befriends her. Mm-hmm. And if you go back to, you know, Arabic, the genie comes from djinn, and djinn means is kind of a fire creature,
right?
Revealed in fire. If you remember how she meets Jack and Hagar, he's about to be burned alive,
and then eventually.
What she most wants in the world is for these people to die, and then of course, what does Jack offer her? He offers her three of her heart's desires. And what does every kid do with the genie when they're imagining this?
You got to try to figure out a way to get those more wishes.
You get two wishes, and then that third wish, you're going to try to get more out of it. And that's exactly right. What Arya does with Jaqen. She tricks the genie into giving her more wishes. And he ends up not just killing three people for her. He kills a lot of people for her. And she's able to liberate herself. So I thought that was interesting. It's one of these things where there's a lot of little clues if you're reading the books. But and probably just Martin having fun. I don't know if this has any predictive value. But that key phrase that she was polishing her hates. So like her kill list prayer functioned kind of like Aladdin's magic lamp.
Right. And I think it's cool. And it's another instance of like what we've seen again and again in this project of like Martin using. So like, is it a, you know, is this something that's proven or like absolutely no, it does appear that this is something that Martin's doing for at least fun, but also like by imbuing his fake world with all these traditions and elements and mythology from our real one, it does lend that kind of verisimilitude. Is that how you say that word?
That sounds good to me, man.
It's how you grant that world that appearance of being lifelike.
Yes.
Because like you could just authentically inhabit the world for thousands of years and like run the simulation and see what kind of weird stuff pops up out of it. Or you could just take the stuff that's already come out of thousands of years of iterations from a real world, you know, obscure it, and it makes it feel lived in automatically. And one of the prime reasons Game of Thrones is so cool.
Yeah. And look, even if the theory doesn't hold water, I mean, it certainly made me enjoy that particular portion of the text even more, just because there were so many little clues that would connect those theories. You know, who knows if you ever sat Martin down and said, hey, were you meaning to do this? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, maybe it's just these stories are so embedded in the Western psyche that we can't help but see them there.
So if you have thought any of these topics we talked about today or any of the topics we've discussed in the last 8 podcasts, essentially, that are about this examination of religions and culture and the fusions that go into it of A Song of Ice and Fire and Game of Thrones, that is our volume 1 and 2 of Gods of Thrones. You can find out more information if you go to godsofthrones.com. It has links to purchase our book on Amazon, both as a physical copy as well as a digital ebook format. And you can also get merch that's got the fantastic art that we commissioned from Chase Stone on it. Not just the cover arts, but the interior art that he did as well. And there's some really tasty stuff that he did for this volume. Man, I don't know what my favorite artwork is because, like, I really like Varys as a mermaid.
That's pretty great, man. Varys is a mermaid. It's pretty good. We do a couple fan theory posters. If you want poster, but, see a poster size, Roose Bolton as a vampire.
Yeah, but Aegon coming to the Dragonstone Sept to ask for a blessing before he begins his conquest of Westeros.
I think if I was going to get one poster, it would be the Clegane Bowl.
Oh, really? Okay. All right.
Well, because Chase is a master when it comes to light. And I think that his use of light in that... Actually, there is light streaming through a series of horn blowers.
The trumpeters, yes. The
trumpeteers, yes. And I just thought that was very well done.
Okay, so we do have some feedback. A lot of people are excited about Game of Thrones coming back in just a few weeks. We're excited about that. I took some of the questions. We're getting a lot of questions that are going to be answered on our preview podcast that's for this season 8 that starts next week. But I thought some of them had some interesting connections to the religion and culture stuff that's kind of, and then the prophetic and, you know, the lore kind of stuff that's more our ballywick, and things that Jim, because he's not a book reader, is less interested in. So I thought maybe we could consider them for ourselves, Anthony.
Let's do it.
Of course, gameofthrones@baldmove.com is where you send feedback. You can also send feedback to forums, or you can post feedback to forums.baldmove.com. There's various topical threads in the Game of Thrones section of our forum. That's where you send it in. Let's get right to it. First up is Bridget D. This is not a question about Club, but it's an important one that I know a lot of people have. I'm not sure if you're able to answer this question, but I know you guys have used HBO Go to watch Game of Thrones in the past. Did episodes premiere the same day and time as they would on TV? I'm debating if I need to subscribe to HBO again or just use HBO Go. I will say that that last year, Jim and I used HBO Go to do all of our live watch coverage and stuff like that. And our experience that the episodes actually posted about 5 minutes before, if the Game of Thrones would post at 9 o'clock or air at 9 o'clock, they would be posted at 8:55. So some of the later, I think that's been true of all the seasons, but some of the earlier seasons and HBO Go wasn't as big of a thing, that sometimes there would be like crashes because the bandwidth would be so crazy that the first week or two there'd be issues with it coming out. And I don't know, like, there's 100 million people supposedly watching this last season. If there's 500 million and they're all using HBO Go, maybe that'll happen again. But in general, yes, you can watch it. You don't have to wait till the next morning or something stupid like that. You can watch it along with everybody else in real time. Okay, moving on. Jamie M. has a history question. Are we sure that dragons are what, in fact, brings magic into the world? Direwolves made a comeback before dragons did. Is it possible that dragonwolves are the real bringer of magic, or the direwolves are a prerequisite for dragons to exist in the world? Kind of a crouching direwolf hidden dragon phenomenon. This would reinforce the theme of John's parents and also John plus Danny. Danny did have to do her sacrifice, only death pays for life thing to bring the dragons about, but maybe coexisting in a time when the wolves were back is what's needed too.
Yeah. Well, here's how I would answer that. So, yes, dragons are enhances magic. We know that magic does exist in the world before the dragons are hatched again. It's just weaker. We also know that direwolves have always existed as long as there have been Starks.
There have always been direwolves in Winterfell. At least stone ones and ones on flags.
Well, but they, you know, you get the sense that in the true north beyond the wall.
Oh yeah,
there's direwolves all around. So yeah. So the fact that they return to, you know, south of the wall is that sort of a is it a portent for what's to come? That's how Catelyn interprets it. Mm-hmm. She interprets the event of the stag, you know, having its horn or antler, sorry, not horn, antlers broken off in the neck of the direwolf mother as this religious symbol of a war to come. And that's how she interprets it. Could it be that actually having a direwolf in proximity to Winterfell and the Starks compounds the magic? I don't know. I'm not sure.
It's tough, especially when you talk about any kind of prophecy, because I'm most steeped in like Judeo-Christian lore, and if you look at like Revelations, there's all kinds of things that happens before, you know, Armageddon, like the moon turns into blood and the seas boil and empty their dead and all this stuff happens, and like is that what brings about Armageddon, or are these signs that pretend to it, like are the dire wolves bringing the dragon, or are they like the heralds of the dragon, or it's very tough because we don't know. I mean, it's magic, so pinning down a causality type of relationship is tough.
And Martin likes to play with this kind of stuff because apocalyptic literature likes dragons, likes to sort of bring dragons to the front, or you know, fell beasts or whatnot. Yeah. In addition to that, there's always some sort of indication of some sign in heaven if something massive is about to happen, which is exactly what Martin does in book two with the comet, right?
Yep.
So, yeah, it could be that these monsters are kind of like Daniel's four beasts that emerge from the ocean.
Right.
Who knows?
So, moving on, we have a question from Jay Edge. Several questions, actually. After seeing the trailer, why would the Night King even go to Winterfell and fight this massive army first? Couldn't he just skirt along the coast, bring winter everywhere, then turn the rest of the continent on Winterfell? I hope they explain this with the Night King's connection to Bran. I'm not a Bran is the Night King kind of guy, just someone who thinks Bran has something to do with him.
What do you think about that?
I think that the Night King's goal is not to turn the thermostat down on Westeros. The Night King's goal is to turn all of the world of men into the world of the dead. And you could make a pretty, on the face of it, compelling argument saying that that's his, that he's following his prime directive. Like, this is a huge mass of humanity that he could turn into his own army. He's flush with his victory at the wall and and turning a dragon, and he's cocksure and he's full of himself, and plus he's just obeying his drive to exterminate all mankind. So why would he duck that battle? Like, when is it going to be a better time for him to turn those living people dead?
Right. And if indeed he, look, what does Winterfell give you? Well, if you can sack it, then you get 10,000 more, you know, foot soldiers for your army of the dead, right?
Right. Plus, who knows, like, if you can get, like, you can plunder the crypts for old, ancient, dead Stark kings, then then you're getting supercharged army.
Yeah.
I there might be something to this connection to Bran. Like, if the Night King correctly identifies Bran as his greatest threat, and, you know, his other greatest threats are Jon Snow and Dany there too, you know, you want to so the longer the thing goes on, both sides get stronger, because the both sides will have a chance to unite. The Night King will have a chance to get more dead people. Like, so it's like, why would you ever want to duck that fight and consolidate your power? I mean, that's what the Night King has been doing for seven seasons. So I don't find it as mysterious as Jay Edge, and maybe some of those reasons you'll find compelling. He also wonders, think we'll finally see Howland Reed come center stage to help Bran and Sam confirm Jon's parentage? If Mira tells him what's coming, I think I'd head to Winterfell too. Well, I'd be headed for the Summer Isles, but if I was Howland Reed, that's what I'd do. So Mira got sent away from Bran, presumably returned to her father. I don't hold out much hope for Howland to show up this late into the season, especially since Bran can just tell Jon. And why would John? what's John's play here? Is he going to Luke Skywalker? No, that can't be true. It's impossible. Like, why would he do that?
Right. No, the Double D's are in the business of creating less characters than there are in the books.
Yes.
And I mean, they're in the business of, let's burn down half of King's Landing.
Yes. Yes. Let's just wipe everyone that you think might be important off the board, except for Cersei.
Right.
Yeah, no, and it's the final season, so even more of that's going to be happening, I think.
Although we do have, we are going to meet a new character related to the Second Sons, right?
That's true, possibly. Yeah, they do the golden boy in the golden armor that's not Jaime Lannister on the ships.
This is sort of their way of bringing the Essos plot to Westeros.
Yeah, or at least some kind of wink-wink nod to that. But yeah, I just think it's too late for Howland. They've already got a mechanism that will, bring John in onto the story that we're all following. In the podcast episode on this episode Spoils of War, Aeron mentions food being very important for the wars to come. I'm going to freak out if they haven't gotten some food from Essos or something to feed everybody that we see in Winterfell in the trailer. I think you're probably setting yourself up for disappointment, because if there's one thing that the Double D's have shown themselves as being really uninterested in thinking about in the last several seasons, it's logistics. Maybe they'll spend 15 minutes of Jon and Sansa and Bran and Arya trying to figure out how we're going to feed all these people. Where are we going to get the bread? Where are we going to get the protein? Where are we going to get the calories and carbohydrates? But I doubt it. There's 1,000 wagons coming from Bearfuck Island, and it's going to give us just enough to get through this 2-week siege, and that'll be it. It'll be a round number of wagons. It'll be from some place that, oh, that sounds right, but you don't really know about. Yeah.
So okay, let's think about this. The Double D's are basically creating the biggest battle scene ever put to a screen, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Battle of Winterfell is going to be that big.
Cinematic history.
That's right. So seems to me like there's been a lot of thought and attention put to this particular event. You could, you know, there could be mention of the special stores at Winterfell. The Winterfell is famously able to use its, what is it, volcanic steam.
They got all the latest inventions that 8,000 years ago Bran the Builder could invent. Yeah. It's got greenhouse glass. It's got geothermal heating. It's got indoor outdoor dragons, probably,
right,
in it, providing the geothermal heating. It's great. It's got it all.
So the other thing is that we know that Dothraki like to. I say Dothraki because I heard Martin say Dothraki.
I think I'm rubbing off on you, is what it is. Like, my thick, stupid tongue is rubbing off on you.
No, I watched an interview with Martin, and he said, I heard him say Brienne.
Yeah.
Instead of Brienne. And he also says, instead of Dothraki, he says Dothraki, like the eye in your eye socket.
He's not. He's also really not sure about how to spell Grumpkins.
So this is maybe one of those times where, like, Lucas says laser sword.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, the Dothraki like to eat horse flesh. Like, that's their preferred meat.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you could imagine that all of these soldiers coming north, that if the food runs out, you just butcher the horses.
PETA also not happy about that.
No, not happy. Not happy.
Finally, they say, if the Night's King is destroyed along with the forces of Winter, this would mean the Night's Watch could also be disbanded. I was half asleep listening to the spoiler cast. Thank you. When you guys talked about Sam taking his rightful seat at Hornhill now that his father and Dick and Tarly are dead, but he couldn't do that unless the Night's Watch is discontinued. What are the implications for the rest of our characters if the Night's Watch is no longer needed? Man, one of the implications is there's going to be no way to commute a death sentence.
I know that the economy of Moletown will suffer.
Think of the ladies of Moletown before you do away the Night's Watch. I don't know. I think there's another question that's later on. Maybe we can talk about this. I think that the Night's Watch is probably going to be ended, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's some sort of Dawn Guard type of organization that's like this purely altruistic military force of defense, or I don't know, because a purely altruistic military force for defense, that sounds very People's Republic to me.
If we believe that the wall will crumble in the canon, then if the wall's gone, then the Night's Watch is not going to help you against the Snarks and Grumpkins beyond the wall. And
right,
it could
be
that the Wildings will populate the gift, and eventually...
That seems a lock, yeah.
Eventually, the one thing you can count on is that there won't be everlasting peace. The factions that have fought in Westeros will just continue to fight once the other enemy is defeated.
Yeah.
So the neck becomes more important. The neck is not passable without the twins, and the twins become the new wall,
which the 67th Frey will inherit.
Right.
And
so the Freys are going
powerful.
To become all powerful.
Yes, yes, that's what we need. That's the bittersweet. That's bittersweet. Danny
sits
on the Iron
Throne. You
can
defeat the Night King, but basically the Freys are now in charge.
Night King's defeated. Cersei's gone. Jon and Danny both sit on the Iron Throne jointly, and they're bouncing beautiful baby boys and girls underneath. It's all lovely, but the actual power in the Seven Kingdoms are the Freys. And that's what you know going forward.
Yep.
All right, let's move on to Sean McGee. I can't get over and rewatching season 5 how Jack and Hagar, noted genie, ends up telling Arya that she has to stop being Arya and become no one, when very clearly he said when they were in Westeros, a girl has a lot of names on her list, and becoming a faceless man can help her cross those names off. Sean McGee, not familiar with military organizations and their recruiting.
Right.
Join the Navy, see the world, and mop this base in South Carolina. I think there's a little, I mean, bait and switch is kind of like stock and trade in that recruitment style, right?
Well, yeah, now I guess, look, the question, Jack says a lot of things that make you scratch your head.
Mm-hmm.
So he seems to have, in the books, he seems to have some special reverence for the red god, R'hllor. And the three lives are owed to the red god, seemingly because the three victims were going to die in a fire. So yeah. If you think, okay, so if that's the case, then maybe the three names that Arya chooses would have to die by fire, but no,
right?
They don't. they die by stabbing. They die by falling from a wall. So I don't know if Jaqen H'ghar is the most trustworthy character.
I mean, you could also play it the other way that, like, he, and this kind of, like, leans into Jaqen's sly smile when Arya essentially says, you know, fuck this, I'm out. Perhaps he knew that she was meant for greater things and the Faceless Men would just be a stepping stone along her journey. And maybe, I mean, I, you know, if you want to read more about what the agenda of the Faceless Men might be and their, and all that philosophy and how, you know, this religion based around freed slaves might play into the book. I mean, you'd have to probably buy our book because it's like 30 pages of discussion on that. But,
yeah. And in addition to that, look, I mean, whoever is running the House of Black and White, there's no reason to think that they're any less corrupt than any other religious institution, right?
True.
So let's not put too much stock in what Jaqen promises.
Mary KC has her final piece of feedback. In the books, the position of 1,000th Lord Commander of the Night's Watch seems to hold some sort of significance. If I'm correct, John was the 998th Lord Commander, and Dolorous Ed is now the 999th. The book setup implies the Night's Watch will continue in some form with a leader of importance. I don't recall any specific prophecy, though. What do you think this means for the show, especially now that the wall has fallen? Does this suggest some sort of new treaty with the Others, and this process starts all over again? If the Others were truly vanquished, what would the Night's Watch do? Could the Night's Watch be turned into a role of honor rather than the pack of murderers, rapists, and thieves that they find themselves in today? And who will command them all? So let's take this as a question first. I think that the show and even the books have done a lot to kind of like... this 1,000th Lord Commander is almost like a Martin teaching us an exercise of, man, when you're dealing with thousands of years of history, some of it pre-recorded, you get a lot of these just-so stories that are not historical. Like, yeah, in the show,
Sam comes...
yeah, he calls bullshit on all this for us.
Right.
I think that's also in the books, too, that he's like, you know, I've actually only been able to find, like, 600...
Right.
This 1,000 is this way. There's just not enough time. So that's one answer, that this is just George saying that, you know, you can't rely on 1,000-year-old prophecies and ancient religions and hokey weaponry. What other ways are there to interpret this?
Well, I mean, Martin does like numerology.
You know, right.
He uses it, for some reason, he uses the number 19 a lot.
Well, so, then the Night's King is at the 13th Lord Commander, so there's lots of loaded significance there.
I mean, in the book, one thing that we talk about is Jon being an interesting character because of his duality. So, not necessarily because he's the 1,000th or the 999, whatever, but just simply because he's such a dual character deep down. He's both wolf and human. He's both southerner and northerner. He's both Stark and not Stark.
Right.
He's both Wilding and member of the Night's Watch. So if you ever wanted a character that would not be able to sort of fight for one side, which is exactly what the Night's Watch is supposed to do, it's Jon Snow. He just doesn't see the world that way. He's conflicted so deep down inside. He's going to call bullshit on the Night's Watch when it needs when that needs to be done, and eventually it kills him, according to the books. So I don't know if the numbers necessarily tell us that story as well as the fact that he's just a deeply divided, conflicted personality does.
Right. I mean, there was definitely some talk, and still is, of like, you know, John's 998, there's going to be someone's going to be 999, and then John's going to be resurrected, and he'll be the 1,000th and last Lord Commander, or, you know, that there'll be an interim Lord Commander, and then the 1,000th is going to be Jaime Lannister, and that's how he's going to redeem himself. Or, but I don't know, and that's... So getting on to the next question, which is, if the Night's Watch is going to remain, which is or is going to transition to some other type of order that does essentially the same kind of role, like a general protector of the realm, who would be the candidates for Lord Commander? Mary suggested Sam Tarly. I don't think Sam would make a great Lord Commander.
I have a suggestion. And I've thought about this for a grand total of 3 seconds.
Okay.
What about Jorah?
Jorah
is clearly not going to get his heart's desire to marry Dany. It's not going to happen.
No.
And he will be repatriated, it seems to me. You know, his sins will be forgiven. And he is, he's a Mormont, so why not?
That would be interesting. What do you think about Tormund? Because
he does say we're the Night's Watch now. That's right.
Yeah, and
he's got to marry Brienne.
Well, but maybe the new Night's Watch, they're just like, you know what? It's kind of stupid that we can't marry. We're rethinking a lot of things. If nothing else, don't you want the wall or the shattered remains of the wall defended by the legendary offspring of Tormund and Brienne? Like, wouldn't you sleep better knowing that our big, tall, redheaded and blonde children they will be the wall. They'll just stand shoulder to shoulder along the border, and you won't need the ice wall. You'll have a 700-foot tall wall of solid flesh and bone.
Okay, so the most prominent person in King's Landing now is Cersei, right? The most prominent person in the north is Sansa. The most prominent faceless man is Arya. We know all men must die.
Yeah.
So why not Brienne being the new Lord Commander of the Night's Watch?
There you go. There you go.
Bingo.
I think another interesting thing is Jaime, because we like Jaime. Jaime, we think, is a fundamentally good guy. But Jaime's done a lot of shit that he really needs to answer for. And I don't know whether you'd say that did that. Maybe that, you know, people, when I say this, people always say, well, you know, he did have all of his children murdered and he lost his arm, his sword arm, et cetera, et cetera. Like, I don't know that in the cosmic balance scales, like how do you, that's why it's hard to judge people. How do you judge a guy who saved King's Landing, who casually tried to murder a child to hide his incest? Like, how do you judge that? One easy way to do it is to have him take the black, or like maybe it's now the white, or whatever, if it's the Dawn Guard. And then because what I like about Jaime Lannister being some sort of Lord Commander is that's the deal he originally took when he was a small boy. Like, I'm going to give up my lands and titles and my prestige just to be a guardian of something greater than myself.
Yes.
And he did that, was vilified by it, and it let his heart grow dark. Maybe he could do it again and like do it right this time. I kind of like that.
Yeah, that's not bad. Either that or he will have his throat cut and he will die.
Yes. One of those things is sure to happen. So that's all the feedback we have for this week. Oh boy, next week, Jim returns. We are going to do an extravaganza of, we're going to do death pools and like we're going to go down percentages of who we think is going to live and die. We're going to talk about more trailer talk, more theory talk. We're going to try to get as much speculation. And again, we have not seen any spoilers. We've not seen any production spoilers. We've tried to keep ourselves virgin as far as that goes. And so far, we've
as
been
pure triumphant. As the driven snow.
As the driven John Targaryen, Aegarian snow. And if you'd like to send feedback for that podcast next week, it is going to be Game of Thrones at baldmove.com. You can discuss it on forums, forums.baldmove.com. If you've enjoyed Anthony and I's discussion today, please check out godsofthrones.com, where you can find links to purchase our book, Gods of Thrones Volume 1 and 2, as well as merch based on the fantastic art by Chase Stone. godsofthrones.com. Anthony, I'm sure we will have you back in this. My intention is to have you back in the weeks to come just to discuss some spoiler stuff and maybe some book topics and things like that, if you're willing.
I am willing. I can't
to
wait.
Continue to promote the book that we all co-authored. So we're gonna be back, and then again the week after that, Game of Thrones starts. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Anthony.